Hey, everybody. Welcome to TYT. Anna Kasparian and Nando Vila with you. Nando's going to be presenting some stories in the post game, and you don't want to miss it. TYT.com/join to become a member. Nando, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well. How are you, Anna?
A little tired, but I'm doing tired. Okay. Yeah.
Friday afternoon.
You know, you have those days and those. Yeah. I can't wait for Saturday afternoon. Saturday afternoon is when I have a little bit of time to like do whatever I want, slash, not really, because I got to prep for my class on Monday. But I am looking forward to our show on Jacobin tomorrow morning, which we host every Saturday morning. People should check that out. Go to youtube.com/JacobinMag to watch weekends every Saturday morning, 10 a.m. Pacific time, 1 p.m. Eastern time. So if you're in the East Coast, you can check that out during the afternoon. And by the way, if you're watching this live, one of the best ways you can help to support the show is to like and share the stream. Let's see, what should our goal for today be? I'm going to stick to 2,500. If we get to 2,500 likes and shares, there will be singing of some sort. I haven't decided what the genre will be yet. I haven't decided if it's going to be me or if it's going to be you, Nando, but it'll be one of us and it'll be fun.
We should do a duet.
I'm down. I mean, who doesn't want to hear a duet? Who? So share the stream, guys, do it. Few programming notes and then we can move on to what we have in the news today. So TYT has been hosting a bunch of specials lately. We actually have a special coming up next week that you don't want to miss. It's the Get Out the Vote special hosted by Cenk Uygur, John Iadarola, Ida Rodriguez, and Benjamin Dixon. You can actually watch that live next Tuesday, September 22nd at 7 p.m. Pacific time, 7:30 p.m. Eastern time, 4:30 p.m. Pacific. Make sure you don't miss that. You can watch that on tyt.com/live, YouTube, Facebook, Twitch. We're all over the places, you guys know. Also, real quick, Emma will be hosting a watch party on our Twitch channel. If you haven't already looked into our Twitch channel, you should go to twitch.tv/tyt to learn more. So you guys can actually vote on what Emma will watch during this watch party on September 19th at 5 p.m. Pacific. I'm sorry, 5 p.m. Eastern time. I'm mixing up everything today. So if you want to vote on which movie you guys will watch with her, just go to tyt.com/poll/Emma. And last but not least, finally, we will be streaming the Imagen Awards. Tune in next Thursday, September 24th at 8 p.m. Eastern time, 5 p.m. Pacific for the 35th annual Imagen Awards, recognizing accomplishments by Latinos in the entertainment industry. Ida Rodriguez will be hosting, so make sure you save the date and watch next week on tyt.com/live. Okay, now let's move on to news. Suddenly there's this 2018 interaction between Tucker Carlson and Cornel West floating around the internet. It's making waves on Twitter. I'm not really sure why it came up, but I will admit that I absolutely love the fact that it did come up, because Cornel West is, in my opinion, one of the best communicators in the country, if not this planet. He has this way of connecting with people, more importantly, using the right language to persuade people, even people as horrendous as Tucker Carlson. Let's take a look.
Fundamental commitment is to the dignity of ordinary people and to make sure they can live lives of decency. So it's not an ism, no brother. It's about decency. It's about fairness. Right. It's about the accountability of the powerful vis-a-vis those who have less power. The workplace, women dealing with the household, gays, lesbians, trans, black people, indigenous peoples, immigrants. How do we ensure that they are treated decently and that the powerful don't in any way manipulate, subjugate, and exploit them?
Well, I mean, if that's what democratic socialism is, then I'm basically on board. I do think that ordinary people, middle class people, ought to have dignity. And I think that our current systems make it hard for them to have dignity. So I agree with all of that.
Now, look, I love what Cornel West had to say there. I think that he's absolutely right. But I'm not a dummy. Of course, I don't believe for a second that Tucker Carlson found it in his soul to all of a sudden support democratic socialism, because he genuinely doesn't care about ensuring that every single group of people have a life of decency. As we know, he has been pretty brutal and vicious toward communities of color, toward immigrants. And so again, that video was from 2018. Let me give you a refresher on the kind of things that Tucker Carlson says today. Here's a video from March of 2020.
Sanders is a self-described democratic socialist. That's bad. There's no doubt. But is it worse than what he believes on policy? It's not even close. You know what's way worse than anything he's ever said about Fidel Castro? His belief, his argument that anyone on the planet who sneaks into the United States should get free health care and free college tuition. That's the case he's making. He clearly doesn't care about the consequences of his plans. Why? There's really only one possible answer, because he doesn't care about the United States or its future. It's obvious that Sanders hates the country he seeks to lead. There's no other explanation for it. And that is a very dangerous quality in a president. The total cost of Sanders' campaign promises, approaching $100 trillion. That's five times the size, not just of our government spending, but of America's entire economy. Where's all that money going to come from?
It's called modern monetary theory, and Bernie Sanders is a strict adherent to it. I really, truly believe that. And in this theory, taxes and regulations are not used to raise money, especially taxes. They're used to punish people that you don't like, punish industries that you don't like, and to take money out of the money supply if you need to do that to help battle inflation. But for the most part, it's used to punish industries, and then you control the economy by essentially controlling how much money you're printing. And you funnel it into the areas of the economy that you want to grow, and then you punish the people you don't like with taxes. And then instead of funneling it to rich people, I'm going to punish rich people with taxes and regulations. I'm going to punish businesses that I don't like fossil fuel companies, and then I'm going to funnel all this money down to you people, the voters. That's what he's promising, essentially. It's 21st
century
socialism.
He's really saying I'm going to funnel it all to myself. It's gonna accrue in the form of power. This is really scary.
That's exactly right.
Justin, thank you for that explanation.
Whoa, Nando, I'm really glad that Bernie Sanders isn't the one who won the Democratic primary, and it's a moderate like Biden, because you know, people like Tucker Carlson would have really gone after Bernie hard. Whereas they're super easy and understanding toward Joe Biden, and they're not in any way referring to him as a Marxist or a socialist, right? It's just amazing.
Yeah. No, it's they're going to accuse everyone of being crazy, kind of like communist anyway. So it doesn't really matter. I mean, those two clips are interesting to see back to back, because it shows like Cornel West. I mean, obviously, like you said, one of the best communicators that we have on our side, just explaining things from a purely humanistic kind of basic decency standpoint, not trying to get into things about the culture war or anything like that, just avoiding kind of the hot button political issues of the day for something that transcends that, you know, about human decency. And like when you're kind of confronted with that head on, if you're someone like Tucker Carlson, you can't respond to that. There's no response to it. Whereas if you start getting into a litany of issues that are just kind of currently in the news for whatever reason, they have all those arguments kind of very well tooled and can come back at you no problem, and you just get into a back and forth. When you kind of transcend that and speak to the basic decency, but also importantly, framing it in class terms as a conflict between the powerful and those who do not have power, you know, there's no one can disagree with you, right? But then it's interesting when he criticizes Bernie, Tucker Carlson, he does it on nationalist grounds. And this is something that I spoke in my commentary last week on Jacobin about right-wing populism. It's where they try not to talk so much about the left's critique of capitalism, more they try to talk about it as on the frame that they're familiar with, which is hardcore nationalism, right? So he says that like Bernie wants everyone to come into the United States and have free healthcare, and that's just like going to have a horde of immigrants that's going to change the sort of fabric of American society. So that's like, that's the only response that Tucker Carlson can come up with. And all of a sudden this like fantasy about, you know, Bernie being an adherent to modern monetary theory, which of which there is no evidence. But then the guy was like talking about like, he's using taxes to punish things like he doesn't like fossil fuel companies and channel that money to regular people. And I'm like, that sounds pretty good. I don't know about you guys. I'll take that.
You know, exactly. No, but you make a really good point about the framing, because if you really stop and think about it, anyone who wants to make a persuasive argument in favor of the types of social programs that Cornel West and Bernie Sanders are in favor of can easily do it if you use the type of framing that we heard from Dr. West in that video, right? This is, because I think deep down, and I know it's hard to believe this, especially considering like the climate that we're living in, I think deep down, even the people who say horrible things do want to at least be good people. I think that they do want most people, everyone, to live a life of decency, right? And when they're confronted with that framing, I think human nature pushes them in the direction of accepting that, as opposed to like who wants to say or admit, who genuinely believes like, no, I think that there are people who should not live a life of decency. I'm sure that kind of person exists. I'm not trying to pretend like, you know, we live in some crazy utopia where people are perfect, but I think most people want the same things. And unfortunately, especially when you're on the left, you need to find almost the perfect framing to cut through just this propaganda machine, which, by the way, Tucker Carlson is very much part of.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he, you know, Tucker Carlson is, I mean, I've followed his career for a long time, ever since he wrote a very long, kind of well-written, but like very right-wing piece about Elian Gonzalez back in like the late 90s. And he was like this young wunderkind kind of conservative that then got his own show on CNN. And he was like this cartoon elitist that would wear a bow tie. And now he's sort of reframing himself or rebranding himself as this sort of working man's hero, when he's just like a cartoon elite and always has been his entire life. But you're right that like when you frame those, that's the thing, is like message discipline around the framing, and it's you advocate for basic human decency and you identify the true enemies, right? The true enemies are basically the people who control the society. Rich and powerful people. Those are the enemies. You have to focus on that, but also do it in a way that comes from a place of humanism, love, transcendence, all that kind of wishy-washy stuff that actually is important and actually makes a big difference. And actually, you know, people respond to kind of intuitively. You know, I mean, it's cliche at this point, but like that's what Martin Luther King did. He like always understood who the enemies were, but like spoke in this universal language of like love and human solidarity, and that's what's going to set us free. And once you're, that's the language you have to use, the sort of just going through like the whatever's going on in the day, it's going to be a dead end. They're always going to be able to win that. They're always going to be able to win the culture war. It's very rough terrain for people on the left to compete in, just because they, you know, they control all the levers of power, all the levers of the media, and they'll always be able to win that argument.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to just how effective right-wing propaganda can be, because it can lead to well-meaning people unfortunately regurgitating it. So, as fires burn through the West Coast, As fires continue to burn through the West Coast and cause devastation to people living in the area, the right wing has unfortunately exploited the tragedy to push through anti-leftist propaganda. One of the conspiracy theories you may have come across on social media is this notion that the fires were actually started by leftist activists. Now, that has been debunked several times, but unfortunately it wasn't debunked aggressively enough before Joe Rogan said this on his show.
I actually love Portland. It's one of my favorite places to perform. Most of the people there are very nice, but there's a madness going on there. You want to talk about madness of crowds? That exemplifies that right now. And it's to me, They've arrested people for lighting forest fires up there. They've arrested left-wing people for lighting these forest fires, you know, air quote activists. And this is something that's also not widely being reported, you know, that people have actually been arrested for lighting fires up there. I don't know what, like, if I would love to talk to the mayor and say, what is your strategy for ending this? Are you hoping this is just going to die down? Yeah. Like, because these people want your head. And they want blood, and they don't seem to be willing to settle for anything less.
There are two types of people who spread misinformation. Okay, there are people who intentionally do it, thus spreading disinformation, and then there are people like Rogan, where I think intentions matter, and he got it wrong. He did apologize, so I want to make sure you guys know, like, he didn't intentionally spread this type of anti-leftist propaganda. He took credit for it. Let's go to his apology. The last two graphics here. He said, "I effed up on the podcast with Douglas Murray and said that people got arrested lighting fires in Portland. That turns out not to be true. I was very irresponsible not looking into it before. I repeated it. I read one story about a guy getting arrested for lighting fires. Turned out to be true. But the other S I read about people getting arrested for lighting fires in Portland was not true. I repeated it without looking into it. And it was a really effed up, stupid mistake that won't happen again. I'm sorry." Okay, so that was a great apology. Okay, he took responsibility. It was an unequivocal apology. So let's just get that out of the way. The story isn't so much about Joe Rogan as it is about how incredibly successful propagandist organizations like Turning Point USA are at just publishing anything, like the most outlandish lies about people, about leftists, about protesters, about BLM. And even someone like Joe Rogan, who should be aware of these types of disinformation campaigns, who should be aware of things like fake news, still just kind of takes it at face value and regurgitates it on a show where millions of people are listening. It kind of blows my mind. But I do want to go to all the different ways the story was debunked even before he apologized. Rogan apologized for the misinformation on his show. So the FBI in Portland actually had to debunk this on Twitter, writing, "Reports that extremists are setting fires in Oregon are untrue. Help us stop the spread of misinformation by only sharing information from trusted official sources." Their second tweet about this says, "Conspiracy theories and misinformation take valuable resources away from local fire and police agencies working around the clock to bring these fires under control. Please help our entire community by only sharing validated information from official sources." Even local police departments, by the way, in Oregon had to respond to these conspiracy theories because they were getting such a high volume of calls. And so they put out a statement, "Rumor spread just like wildfire, and now our 911 dispatchers and professional staff are being overrun with requests for information and inquiries on an untrue rumor that six Antifa members have been arrested for setting fires in Douglas County, Oregon. Read a Facebook post from the Douglas County Sheriff's Office in Oregon. This is not true." And then there's the Jackson County Sheriff's Office in Oregon also posted, "We are inundated with questions about things that are fake stories. One example is a story circulating that varies about what group is involved as to setting fires and arrests being made." So again, it's been debunked. And I mentioned Turning Point USA for a reason, because a tweet from a self-described representative for conservative youth group Turning Point USA, which has been shared about 2,900 times, said the fires were allegedly linked to Antifa and the riots. As we know, that's not true. But Nando, I mean, it's... I don't know what the right response is, right? Because even well-meaning people, they just fall for it. Yeah. And it gets repeated, regurgitated. No one questions anything. No one's ever skeptical of things like this. They just accept it at face value because the right is really good at propaganda and controlling a narrative.
Yeah, and it's frustrating. You know, Joe Rogan has had on his show a guy named Tom O'Neill, who wrote a book called Chaos, which was all about, you know, it started off as an investigation into the Manson murders, but then really became a story about how the FBI and the CIA and local police departments worked together to basically infiltrate left-wing groups and create panic and hysteria over them. You know, so you would think that he could see this coming from a mile away. I mean, this was so obviously untrue that even the FBI. The FBI is denying it. Like, the FBI denying like left-wing shenanigans like should tell you that this is like insanely untrue, right? I mean, the FBI would be happy to pin the wildfires on Antifa. You know, like they should love to do that. But this, like, it just, this story holds absolutely no water. And you would think, you know, like that's what's frustrating about someone like Rogan, is that it's like, he's agreed, well-meaning and very integral, I find, and honest in his apology kind of reflects that. Like, no one, like no cable news host would have that kind of mea culpa for screwing up big time. I mean, it happens all the time. But they never kind of admit something like this. Like, I mean, he was just completely like, no excuses. This is, but he does fall for this kind of thing of just believing whatever the latest thing he heard without, you know, really kind of thinking too much about it beyond whatever the latest thing he heard is, you know? So yeah, you know, it's frustrating. And like what the reality is that most people just aren't equipped to deal with misinformation and propaganda, which is why we have to find some sort of solution to it. Like, there's just no, you know, this is something that, there used to be laws in place against it. There used to be kind of federal regulations against it. They were often abused and all that stuff. But at the end of the day, like, there was kind of an expectation that it was, you had to report things that were true, you know, and that those laws were kind of dismantled. But in the 1980s, but you know, like, there has to be some sort of way that we can regulate as a society the information that flows around, you know, like that flows, that is integral to the maintenance of a functioning society, is like accurate and true information so that we can make informed decisions. Like, if we don't take some sort of control over that, some sort of democratic control over the information, like, we're going to be in a endless spiral of fake news and misinformation campaigns and all that, because there's just no way to stop it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I don't know what the right mechanism is to you know, prevent the spread of this type of disinformation. But the one thing that, you know, I hope Rogan's waking up to is, look, it's a false equivalent to say that the left and right are the same. They're not. They're not.
Yeah.
So I appreciate and respect the fact that he's open-minded. He wants to have people with all different opinions and, you know, ideological identities surrounding him. That's great. But I hope that he's at least keeping tabs on the number of right-wing guests he's had on who ended up being grifters, who ended up being liars. You know, like, it's happened so many times. Like, he's now openly calling Dave Rubin stupid on his show. But and I'm glad, like, he came to that realization. He's not a dumb guy. He came to that realization. He knows that Dave Rubin is what he is. But it's not just about Dave Rubin. Like, I feel like people he regards as friends fill his head with all sorts of disinformation. Yeah. It drives me nuts, because sometimes he repeats it on his show and I'm just like, I really like this interview you're having, but like, that kind of stuff turns reasonable people who do want to hear other opinions off. You know what I'm saying?
No, and people, I'm not the first one to point this out, but like, Rogan is popular. First of all, because he's a very talented interviewer, but also because he's pretty much an avatar for the average, the way the average American interacts with politics and the news. He does kind of, you know, most Americans are kind of like Rogan in their political beliefs. They have these kind of heterodox beliefs that don't adhere to the standard kind of partisan liberal versus like Democratic versus Republican divide that we see kind of in the discourse all the time. Most Americans are kind of like Rogan in that they reject both of the parties and they kind of hold heterodox beliefs around the other stuff, right? And Rogan is just kind of a perfect avatar for it, in that he like you know, believes things like, you know, that there should be single payer healthcare, Medicare for all is like a sort of like obvious thing to him. But that also, like, there's these like bands of Antifa roving around, like murdering people willy nilly or whatever, you know, like, but that's pretty much probably what, like, if you just kind of go out in the world and talk to the average American, they're more or less, they're more like him than, Joyanne Reed on MSNBC. Like, no one has her political beliefs. You know what I mean? Or her political identity.
Yeah, no, you did a good job. You did a good job turning a negative into a positive. It could be worse. It could be Joyanne Reed, and I prefer Rogan, because at least he's open-minded.
For example, Joyanne Reed is a perfect example of someone who was caught in a lie, or caught in a bad thing, and refused to apologize. Just kind of plowed right ahead through it. And Joe Rogan, when he's caught, you know, and he, to his credit, he admits it, and that's why people respect him a little bit more.
Yeah, he takes responsibility for sure. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we have more news for you, including rejected ballots in a swing state. Take a guess which demographic had the highest number of rejected ballots. I'll tell you when we return.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Hey guys, welcome back to TYT. Anna and Nando with you. Engineer writes in from our members section, and you can become a member by going to tyt.com/join. And the comment is, Anna, Rogan's apology was on Twitter, not his show, so smaller audience. Also, he didn't say leftist in the apology as he did in the original claim. Not a perfect apology. I hear you. He issued that apology today, I believe around 11 a.m. Pacific time. I only say that because he might host a show soon where he does bring it up. I don't know. But I hear you. I think that's a valid criticism. Also, from Super Chat, the progressive linguist wants Charlie as the reward. If we hit 2,500 likes and shares of this stream. So if you haven't done so already, please do so. It's an easy way to help support TYT and get the message out there. All right, without further ado, let's get to the rest of the news. Earlier this week, we heard from a whistleblower out of Georgia. She's a nurse who works at a private prison facility that detains undocumented immigrants. And she said that she was suspicious of the high number of hysterectomies that were being performed on women in this detention center. She felt that the women didn't actually know that they were going to get the procedure and had not really consented to the procedure. Well, now the Associated Press has looked into this story, and they have spoken to some women who have unfortunately experienced this. And here's what we're learning now. An Associated Press review of medical records for four women and interviews with lawyers revealed allegations that Dr. Mahendra Amin performed surgeries on detained immigrants that they never sought or fully understood. So there's a specific example of a 39-year-old Cuban woman who was actually told that she would undergo an operation to treat her ovarian cysts. But a month later, she's still not sure what procedure she underwent. So she keeps asking them questions and she can't get a straight answer. She was quoted as telling the Associated Press, "The only thing they told me was you're going to go to sleep and when you wake up, we will have you finished, or we will have finished. So there was a lack of information, given to her prior to the surgery. They told her that they needed to deal with ovarian cysts. They're not answering questions now. Now, after she repeatedly requested her medical records to find out, Irwin County Detention Center gave her more than 100 pages showing a diagnosis of cysts, but nothing from the day of the surgery. So they just keep refusing to give her the information she wants. So she also kept her hospital bracelet, and that's how she found out that it's likely she was given a hysterectomy. It has the date August 14th, and part of the doctor's name, and it is the doctor who was referenced earlier, a gynecologist linked this week to allegations of unwanted hysterectomies and other procedures done on detained immigrant women that eliminate their ability to have children. That's what a hysterectomy does. It removes either part or the entirety of a woman's uterus.
Yeah.
This is happening bad. in our country. Yeah. No, it's beyond bad. I mean, and look, I don't want anyone to think like we don't have a history of this, because we do. California has a history of sterilizing female prisoners. And so it's not far-fetched that it could happen again. And of course, I mean, we're dealing with a prison, a private prison that's operating this facility, okay? Strike one. Just read about the history of private prisons and how unbelievably brutal and vicious they've been to people in custody. And then number two, under the Trump administration that has gone to great lengths to dehumanize people, it wouldn't surprise me at all that something like this would be going on.
Yeah. No, it seems pretty clear that what's going on here is that this private prison company, I think it's called LaSalle, that operates this ICE detention center, like they get paid more if they're billing the government for these surgeries. So, you know, there's maybe it's not like, you know, the cartoon villain Nazi guy who just like has this mad scientist thing, but it's kind of thing where it's like, they're quick to pull the trigger on, you know, like a little problem. Yeah, just surgery. More surgery. The more surgeries you bill for, the more money you get paid. You make money on each surgery. It's the insanity of healthcare for profit. It's the insanity of prison for profit. Like it just creates these horrible, horrible incentives, which will eventually win the day. But like you said, this is like there's been a long history in America of forced sterilization. I know that in Puerto Rico, for example, because they were American citizens and could emigrate to the United States. Basically anytime they wanted, there was this like panic in the 1930s and 40s that there would be like hordes of Puerto Ricans coming over. So they basically, and that they were gonna like take over, you know, entire cities and things like that. So they basically sterilized almost like a third of the women in Puerto Rico in the 1940s. God. Yeah, I mean, it's a very little known story. There's a very good book called The War Against All Puerto Ricans that describes this process in great detail. A guy named Cornelius Rhodes was the head of it. He was then put on the cover of Life magazine for his efforts. But it's just this insane system that we have. And like you said, obviously fomented by the Trump administration, obviously these ICE detention centers think they can operate with impunity because no one's really going to look into them. I mean, the Trump administration is not going to look into them. They're not going to care if there's rampant criminality going on. It's horrible. I don't know like what else to say about it.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the stories. I mean, there's no, what analysis can we give other than this is brutal, horrendous. And this is, I mean, again, if there's a profit motive here, of course, whenever there's a profit motive, whenever there's an opportunity for a private corporation, in this case, LaSalle, to increase their profits by billing the government for certain medical procedures, then yeah, they're going to take advantage of that. They're going to abuse it. We've seen it happen in a number of various contexts. And it doesn't matter. Like, there is no question about morality here. I mean, obviously, we find it immoral. But when it comes to a private corporation and its financial interest, they're not thinking about morality. They're thinking about their bottom line, and they're thinking about their investors. That's how this works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the insanity of taking things that should be public goods, public, you know, operations, publicly funded things, and taking them private and putting in a profit motive. I mean, there's going to be abuse in that sense. It's just someone's going to take advantage of it. Someone's going to do it. And, you know, we just have to take away that incentive. Like, yes, we can morally shame and condemn these people as we should because they are monsters. But as long as the system remains in place, there will be others who do the same. You know, the sort of like, we're going to hold them accountable or whatever, like eventually it's going to happen again and again. You need to eliminate the profit motive altogether from healthcare and from prisons, 100% full stop.
So I took my first break a little late. I'm going to go ahead and take the second break early. That way we'll have ample time to do our next two stories. When we come back from the break, we'll talk about rejected ballots out of North Carolina, a pretty important swing state. And later in the show, we'll talk about the latest uptick in coronavirus cases.
At TYT, we frequently talk about all the ways that big tech companies are taking control of our online lives, constantly monitoring us and storing and selling our data. But that doesn't mean we have to let them. It's possible to stay anonymous online and hide your data from the prying eyes of big tech. And one of the best ways is with ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN hides your IP address, making your active ID more difficult to trace and sell to advertisers. ExpressVPN also encrypts 100% of your network data to protect you from eavesdroppers and cyber criminals. And it's also easy to install. A single mouse click protects all your devices. But listen, guys, this is important. ExpressVPN is rated number one by CNET and Wired magazine. So take back control of your life online and secure your data with a top VPN solution available, ExpressVPN. And if you go to expressvpn.com/TYT, you can get 3 extra months for free with this exclusive link just for TYT fans. That's expressvpn.com/TYT. Check it out today.
Come right back. Hey guys, welcome back to TYT. Anna and Nando with you. All right, let's take a look at the thermometer where I beg you guys for money because that's what we do now. We are fundraising, trying to raise enough money to keep TYT sustainable. Our fundraising effort is at tyt.com/go. The goal was to raise $200,000 this month and we are nowhere near it. But I do want to say thank you to all of our supporters for donating to this effort and keeping us honest and sustainable. We love you guys. Also, we are at 1,400 likes and shares of this stream, which means we're nowhere near the goal that I set out for 2,500 likes and shares. So Charlie is unlikely to make an appearance on this show unless somehow Brett updates me later today and lets me know that we hit that goal. In that case, Charlie will make an appearance. Okay. So I'm going to move on to the rest of the stories because I think it's important to talk about what's happening in North Carolina with some of these ballots. So new reporting regarding mail-in ballots in swing state North Carolina indicate that some of these ballots are being trashed. Okay, they're being rejected. And so there was an analysis into which ballots in particular tend to get rejected. And the results are not shocking, but I'm going to give you the results anyway, because it just further reinforces some of the concerns people have when it comes to how these elections are being carried out. So the early results on mail-in voting from one of the most crucial states in the country are in, and black voters' ballots are getting rejected more than 4 times as often as white voters' ballots. Of the more than 60,000 votes cast by white voters so far in North Carolina, 644 had been rejected as of Thursday at a rate of 1.07%. By comparison, 13,539 black voters had cast their ballots with 597 rejections and a rate of 4.41%. So as you guys can see, the ballots that are being turned in by black voters are being rejected. And look, this analysis didn't go into the specifics as to why it's happening, but I do think that it is, you know, something to be concerned about. So of the 1,390 ballots that have been rejected in North Carolina, 46% came from white voters and 43% were cast by black voters. By comparison, 74% of the accepted ballots were cast by white voters and 16% were cast by black voters. So there's some significant disparity there when it comes to ballots based on the demographic turning them in, namely black individuals and white individuals.
Yeah, you know, in 2013, the Supreme Court basically struck down the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which was the most important law of the civil rights movement. It was the one that actually gave teeth to a lot of the previous civil rights acts in 1964, 1957. Like, they were all kind of meaningless until they were coupled with the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which stated that, you know, in the states that had a history of racial discrimination in voting patterns, that they would have to have pre-clearance from the federal government to make any change in like the voting protocol. Or whatever. That was basically struck down in 2013. And now you're obviously seeing in a lot of those states, especially in the South, the former, you know, the states of Jim Crow and the Confederacy, a lot of these things coming back. And, you know, the reason why the Voting Rights Act was so good is because you didn't need to prove kind of racist intent. Like, it's like, who knows whether, like, you know, black people are obviously like disproportionately poorer than white people in the South. So, like, and that has all kinds of effects in, like, when they're like a registering to vote and, you know, how they can fill out forms and things like that. But that doesn't matter. The intent doesn't matter. The point is that, like, it's at a rate of four times more. Therefore, you know, according to the Voting Rights Act, the federal government would be able to step in and remedy the situation. But now they can't because the Supreme Court said we can't do that anymore. So the centerpiece of civil rights has been gutted, and this is the effect.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you know, anytime there was a statewide effort to change some of the election regulations, especially in southern states, the Voting Rights Act ensured that the state would have to check with the Department of Justice. In this case, you know, it's a little different because you have William Barr running it, so I wouldn't really trust him. But the point is, there was a system of oversight to ensure. Yeah. That any effort to disenfranchise voters would be squashed immediately. That's gone now. And we are seeing the negative ramifications of that. But also, you know, to a broader point that I want to make, Nando, and I want to get your thoughts more importantly. Everyone keeps talking about how important it is to vote in this election, how important it is to support Joe Biden, how important it is to get Donald Trump out. But I feel like there isn't enough emphasis on undoing, you know, some of the damage that the Republican Party has already, like how they've already implemented certain policies that disenfranchise voters, how all this disinformation is being spread by Trump and his cronies about how mail-in ballots lead to widespread rigging. Like, there isn't really an effective counter response by Democrats. Luckily, a federal judge just yesterday ruled that Louis DeJoy, as the Postmaster General, must reverse all of the operational changes he made in the post office, which of course are gonna make it incredibly difficult for the post office to process this high number of incoming mail-in ballots. So that's a little bit of good news. But the election is just weeks away. I mean, we're pretty close. And I just don't think there's been enough done to ensure that this is gonna be a free and fair election.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, the sort of liberal obsession and is that voting is kind of like the moral thing that you do in a way to express your morality or in some way, like that it is the sort of bedrock of the system of democracy. They do all these kind of campaigns, vote or die, rock the vote, you know, they love all this stuff. But when it comes to actually protecting the mechanisms of how people can vote, like the Republicans are just like ruthlessly focused on power and how that works. Whereas liberals are just kind of like standing on the sidelines, you know, kind of cheering on people to vote, but not actually making it easy to expand the access to voting. It's incredibly infuriating. I mean, this has been going on for years. Like, I mean, the resistance to it, like the it's just been absolutely nil. You know, like when Democrats are in power, they need to institute the kind of nuts and bolts reforms that aren't, I mean, beyond like things like healthcare for all, free public education for all those things, which would be great. But like just as a ruthless way to maintain their own power, they should be instituting things that make it incredibly easy for people to vote. Because there are more Democrats in the United States than more people vote Democrat for the United States than Republicans. That's true at the presidential level. I mean, the Democrats have won the popular vote. Like, they won it in 1992, they won it in 1996, they won it in 2000, they lost in 2004, they won in 2008, they won in 2012, and they won in 2016. There's more Democrats there. And if you look at the Senate, it's the same thing. More people vote for Democratic senators than Republican senators, but there's more Republican senators because of the way it's distributed. But so if the Democrats were ruthlessly focused on just this hyper kind of technocratic fix that would allow them to maintain more of their power, as feckless and corrupt as we think they are, you know, and we can critique them all we want, like they also just don't understand how to maintain their own power. It's like the Republicans do that all the time. You know, that's what they're hyper focused on.
Yeah. I mean, there's just, all I see is that giant mountain that Democrats have to climb, because it's, of course, everything we just mentioned right now, the importance of making it easy for people to vote and ensuring that it's a free and fair election. At the same time, though, even before that, they need to encourage people, inspire people to show up and vote or mail in their ballots. And by the way, if you happen to be one of the people living in North Carolina who had your ballot rejected, you can still vote in person. Okay, so don't let that discourage you. Whether you're black, white, I don't care if you're going to vote for Biden, Trump, although you're going to vote for Trump. Maybe, no, you can't. I'm just kidding. You can go to the polling place. You can vote. So please do that, because it is important for you to take part in this process. But yeah, you need to inspire people, number one, and you need to ensure that you protect like the mechanism in which people can vote for you so you can maintain power. And they're just awful at it. And people think when I say this, I'm just bitter because Biden's the candidate. No, we're past that. I'm trying to help. Like the fact that that people reject just information and evidence that can help blows my mind. But here we are. That's what we're dealing with. Okay, we're up to 1,800 likes. So we
Come
still
on,
need
guys.
Quite a bit. Quite a bit.
Come we need, on, guys. You're making 2,500. Me feel bad over here. In front of my
Charlie
friends,
really wants to say
bad.
Hi.
Yeah.
It is Friday, but Charlie's ready to party. So. All right, we got one more story for you, and it's about COVID, so get ready. Coronavirus cases had finally started to decline. But now, after a decline in the summer, the US is experiencing yet another uptick in new COVID-19 cases, with a 13% increase last week alone. Let me give you some of these numbers. So new daily cases averaged about 39,700 over a week as of Thursday. That average has risen the past few days to 13% higher than the week before. And that's according to data from Johns Hopkins University. This comes after weeks of decline from a summer surge. It's well below the summer peak average of 67,300 on July 22nd. So that was the peak. Following that, the numbers started to finally decrease. And then as of last week, we experienced another unfortunate 13% uptick in new coronavirus cases. And this is something to be concerned about, because we're about to enter flu season. So hospitals are very much concerned that they're going to be slammed with regular seasonal flu patients on top of coronavirus patients. This is why it's so important for people to just wear a mask. Just wear your mask. Just wear the mask. Okay, just do it. Why is this so difficult? And by the way, I mean, we're not going to shut down again. We're going to keep doing what we're doing. But in the very least, like minor actions you can take on a personal level, just take them, because again, like, we don't have enough hospital beds. We don't have enough doctors. Our hospitals are not equipped to deal with a giant influx of flu patients and coronavirus patients. So just be considerate of other people. Be considerate about your own health. Anyway, I'm now rambling, Nando, but why don't you jump in?
Did you see that lady? It was like in a Utah news report that was like, you know, when George Floyd said, "I can't breathe," they killed, like, you know, everyone was up in arms, and now we say we can't breathe and they make us wear a mask. But I mean, you know, the mask thing is so important because we're gonna get no help from the government, like no help from the political class at all. Like, I mean, just last week the French legislature passed an 84% furlough payroll like guarantee that, like, for all employees that were furloughed, they're gonna get 84% of their paycheck to encourage people to, like, continue the lockdown while they can deal with the coronavirus pandemic. Here we're gonna get no help. Like, people are gonna have to go to work. People are gonna have to make a living somehow. There's no, like, relief in terms of foreclosures, evictions. All that's going away. They're even like gonna start shutting off people's heating and power and all that stuff because they can't pay the bills. None of the help is coming, at least for the foreseeable future. So it's really on us, unfortunately, because the system is not going to help you. So the mask really is just the thing that can save us the most, or at least keep us kind of stitched together in some small way.
No. We're in America. Don't say stitched together. Do not say stitched together. That'll dissuade people from wearing masks. We live in the United States. No, you have to speak a language that people are more responsive to, I guess. Okay, so hospital bills are very expensive. If you end up getting hospitalized from COVID, you might find yourself in financial ruin because we live in the United States. Please wear a mask. Right? Like, yeah, like, frame it in a way. By the way, what I just said is absolutely true. Articles are starting to be written by specific people. They're profiling coronavirus patients who had to be hospitalized. Luckily, they recovered, but they're being slammed with medical bills, which, you know, to your point, Nando, they're not going to get any help paying for those bills. They're terrified. They don't know what they're going to do about it. Some people might have to file for bankruptcy. So, you know, I get it. Look, I hate wearing a mask. I hate it. I hate that I have to, like, remember it. I think that it is uncomfortable, right? And I don't like the way it feels on my face. But guess what? I'm very much concerned about other people, not just myself. But if I was just some narcissistic, self-absorbed a-hole, then in that case, I would be worried about the medical bills that come along with a hospital stay due to coronavirus. And, you know, just to kind of juxtapose the United States to other countries, Israel is also experiencing an uptick in coronavirus. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is also a right winger, is like, we're shutting down. We're shutting down immediately. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. There was a small protest about it. Didn't care. He's like, no, we got to shut down. We got to keep people safe. And so he's implementing a 3-week shutdown. The 3-week lockdown will begin 2 p.m. today, closing many businesses and limiting public gatherings. The move comes just hours before the beginning of the Jewish high holidays, when people usually attend religious services and gather with family and friends. Under the order, people must remain within 1 kilometer from their home, except for when shopping for food and medicine, attending protests. So he's like, all right, you guys don't like this. You want to protest? Go ahead. He's allowing the protests to happen and going to work. So I'm not saying this because I think, like, Benjamin Netanyahu is such a great leader. I'm saying it because compare these two right-wing leaders. One of them is a doofus who only cares about the stock market. The other one, you know, luckily is willing to do what it takes to keep his people safe. So any final thoughts before we have to go, Nando?
And it's just like, we don't even know the half of this disease, you know, like, it could have long-term effects. We have no idea. So I'm not taking any chances. Like, I don't know. I find it crazy that people would take chances with it. Like, who knows what this thing does? Seriously.
I know.
All right, we're so up to close.
2,200 likes. We haven't made it. But if we hit that number during the members only post game, Charlie might make an appearance. TYT.com/join to become a member. We're going to do some more news for you guys. See you then.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Young Turks. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, Cenk Uygur, and I'll see you soon.